This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 22nd of September, these are our main stories. Dozens of Israeli warplanes have been carrying out widespread attacks on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. Elon Musk has backed down in his legal fight with a Brazilian judge who closed down his social media platform X in the country. Vladimir Kara-Murza, the Russian dissident freed in a prisoner swap last month, has told the BBC he thought he was about to be executed when guards came to fetch him in the night. Also in this podcast, in France...
You go back to the 16th century and beyond, and you've got kings declaring that their role in life, that their purpose is to put chicken in everybody's pot.
No wonder council workers are revolting over a decision to introduce vegetarian-only canteen food twice a week. The Israeli military says dozens of its planes have carried out more widespread airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. They say they took the action after identifying plans by the movement to escalate rocket attacks on Israel. In anticipation to retaliatory strikes, Israel announced restrictions on civilian gatherings from the northern city of Haifa up to the border with Lebanon. On Saturday evening, Daniel Hagari, a spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, gave this update.
In the last hour, we've been attacking widely in southern Lebanon, following the identification of Hezbollah's preparations to fire into Israeli territory. Dozens of warplanes are currently attacking terror targets and launchers to eliminate the threats against the citizens of Israel.
Well, earlier, Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militant group, fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel from Lebanon. The ongoing cross-border strikes by both sides have raised fresh concerns about the conflict escalating even more and spreading even further. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warned that the escalation in fighting could ignite a regional war. Andrea Tenenti is a spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping mission UNIFIL in Beirut.
Definitely the situation now is really concerning, and the escalations of these days also very worrying, and all actors need to immediately de-escalate. A solution is still possible, but of course you need a commitment of the parties, and at the moment the situation is more than concerning that could potentially escalate to a wider conflict, and not only a conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, but a regional conflict.
Karen Giannone spoke to the BBC's senior international correspondent, Orla Garin, who's in Beirut, on Saturday evening and got the latest.
Tonight, Israel has been stepping up its bombardment of southern Lebanon. Now, it says it is doing that in response to intelligence it had that Hezbollah was planning to carry out a series of attacks on Israel. So Israel is presenting this as preemptive action on its part. It says dozens of warplanes are involved. We've been receiving video from locations in the south which show really massive airstrikes taking place. And that's been the situation throughout the day today and indeed yesterday. Some of the heaviest bombardment that we have seen in this year-long conflict. Now, we also know that today Hezbollah, for its part, the Iranian-backed group, it isn't backing down. It has continued firing rockets across the border into Israel, up to 100 rockets. And Israel says that specifically it was targeting Hezbollah rocket launch sites. But I have to say in broad terms that if the international community was worried before about what's going on here, and I think it certainly was, well, I imagine it will be much more concerned tonight. The images we're seeing from the border area show large explosions, show fires on the southern side of the border. We're told there are also fires on the Israeli side. And of course, in recent days, Israel has been stepping up its attacks on Hezbollah. First of all, with the exploding walkie-talkies, the exploding pagers, and then, of course, yesterday's deadly airstrike here in Beirut, in which the death toll has now risen to 37.
And those series of attacks and all sorts of different methods, all of that you mentioned, what impact have the last few days had on Hezbollah's capacity to fight?
I think we can't be sure about that yet, but it has certainly been devastating. It's been a series of devastating blows for the organisation. First of all, countrywide, its communications network has been severely disrupted. Many of its members have been injured, many innocent members of the public also, and indeed two children died during that wave of attacks, the exploding pagers when they picked them up. So many Hezbollah members wounded, many, many killed, the communications network disrupted. Then yesterday, Israel targeted a very senior military commander, Ibrahim Akil, managed to kill him and other senior commanders who were meeting below ground in Beirut. That will have had an impact on Hezbollah's ability to respond. We just don't yet know how and when it's going to be able to mount a response and what level of response it can manage at this stage.
Orla Guerin in Beirut. For months now, there's been a standoff between Brazil and the social media platform X. The app was suspended in the country last month on the basis that hundreds of accounts were spreading disinformation and far-right views. But now the New York Times says an agreement has been reached in court. Our America's regional editor is Leonardo Rocha.
What the New York Times says is that Elon Musk, his lawyers, told them that they have decided to abide by the court orders in Brazil. There were three conditions that the Supreme Court judge in charge of the case, Alexandre de Moraes, had put to X, said they had to block the accounts of about 300 people accused of spreading disinformation and anti-democratic information or far-right views. They had also to reappoint a legal representative in Brazil, and they had to reopen their office in Brazil. And all that changed last month when Elon Musk refused to do. He called the judge Moraes a criminal, authoritarian, and just refused. He closed the office, basically so that there would be no legal representation for his company in Brazil. But that has cost him probably a thousand millions of users, and he's now decided to backtrack and to abide by the legislation. What the New York Times is saying is that X services should be resumed in Brazil in the next few days.
And this spat between X and the Brazilian authorities goes back some way, doesn't it? Talk us through the context.
It's been going on for a while, because what you had in Brazil is, with the previous government, the right-wing government of Jair Bolsonaro, this judge started to look into the president himself and his supporters and saying they were spreading fake news online and calling, for example, for a military coup, calling for the closure of the Supreme Court, closure of Congress, which banned by the Brazilian constitution. So that was going on before this whole spat with X started. And then many of those people, those users, were spreading these messages or posting their messages through the social media platform X. And then the judge was checking what's called the fake news inquiry, told him, look, these are the lists of people that we've checked and they need to be banned or suspended from your services. And Elon Musk said, this is against the law. This is censorship. This goes against the Brazilian constitution, the basic principles of freedom of speech, and I'm not going to abide by the law. So the Brazilian Supreme Court was issuing fines, making threats until last month. They decided, look, your services are suspended. And that's where we are now. They have about 20 million users in Brazil. It's one of the biggest in the world. And I think that Elon Musk didn't want to lose that.
Yeah, so it's good for X. They get those tens of millions of users back in Brazil. As you said, it must have been tough for Elon Musk to capitulate like this.
Not only for him, but also for supporters of the former President Bolsonaro and many people who saw him as a beacon of liberty in Brazil that were going to challenge the Supreme Court. But, for example, what's being said is he compromised to government demands in India and Turkey, for example, because those are important markets. But what I've seen online from people who are living abroad in the United States, who are, say, conservative right-wing supporters, they're very disappointed with Elon Musk bowing to pressure from the Supreme Court judge.
Leonardo Rocha. The US Vice President Kamala Harris has accepted an invitation from CNN to hold a second debate with Donald Trump in the run-up to November's presidential election. Her campaign team said Mr. Trump should have no problem agreeing to the challenge, given that he believed he'd won their recent head-to-head and the format was the same. But the former president said it was too late to hold another debate.
The problem with another debate is that it's just too late. Voting has already started. She's had her chance to do it with Fox. You know, Fox invited us on, and I waited and waited, and they turned it down. They turned it down. But now she wants to do a debate right before the election with CNN because she's losing badly.
Ms. Harris is widely considered to have outperformed her Republican challenger in September's contest. Mr. Trump had already ruled out holding a second. Staying with the US presidential election, here's a quick message from Oliver Conway.
Hi all, just a quick reminder that in the run-up to the US presidential election, we'll be doing a special podcast in collaboration with our friends at BBC Americast. But we need your help to come up with questions to put to the team in the US. So if there's anything you'd like to know, please send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or tweet us at Global News Pod. And if possible, please record your question in a voice note. Thank you.
Thanks, Ollie. Now, a leading Russian dissident, freed in a prisoner swap, has said he thought he was about to be executed when guards came to fetch him. Vladimir Kara-Murza had been given a 25-year sentence for treason after criticising the war in Ukraine and had already served nearly a year in solitary confinement. Mr. Kara-Murza told the BBC what happened.
I was asleep when suddenly the doors to my prison cell burst open and a group of prison officers barged in. I was woken up, I saw that it was dark. I asked what time it was. They said 3 a.m. And they told me to get up and get ready in 10 minutes. And at that moment, I was absolutely certain that I was being let out to be executed. But instead of the nearby wood, they took me to the airport, handcuffed with a prison convoy, boarded me on a plane and flew me to Moscow.
He said that his release from prison still feels surreal.
Since the prisoner exchange, it has felt as if I've been watching some kind of a film. It's a very good one, but it still does not feel real because just a few weeks ago, I was sitting in my 2x3 meter cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison in Siberia, thinking that I was never getting out of there. And here I am sitting with you. This exchange is testimony to the fact that at the end of it all, public opinion in democratic countries is more powerful than any dictatorship can ever hope to be.
Vladimir Kara-Murza. In the German state of Brandenburg, people will head to the polls on Sunday in another election dominated by immigration. Earlier this month, the anti-migrant far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, won an election for the first time. It's all very different from a decade ago when the then-Chancellor, Angela Merkel, allowed in 1.5 million refugees and migrants. Many of them are now becoming German citizens. But how do the new Germans feel about the increasingly hostile debate around migration? Damian McGuinness has been finding out.
So we are in Smetanastraße 31 in front of the school gym hall where I used to live for 6 months.
In 2015, Parveen spent months travelling, mostly on foot, from Afghanistan to Europe with her 3-year-old son and her disabled nephew. They were shot at by border guards, and Parveen feared for her life in the Mediterranean when the overcrowded rubber dinghy they were in, crossing from Turkey to Greece, started sinking.
Somehow you got to forget the person you are and how you were living in your country like a human being. That was breaking me down. Life has changed a lot. Recently, I received my citizenship.
The image I remember most from 2015 is Munich train station, where many refugees arrived in Germany for the first time. Most had come from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. They were greeted by locals holding up signs saying welcome and handing out food, drink, and teddy bears. And many Germans suddenly felt proud of the nation's newfound identity as a welcoming safe haven. But what became known then as the welcome culture is today hard to find.
3 people were killed, 8 more suffered severe knife wounds after a man attacked people, apparently at random.
Germany is in a political meltdown over migration, in part because of the fallout of a brutal stabbing in the town of Solingen in August.
He was a Syrian asylum seeker.
They say he is a member of the Islamic State group.
The attack has only played into the hands of those who wish to connect refugees and migrants with crime and terror.
Right now, everything is coming to a head. And now is the opportunity to say we're incredibly afraid and we know we are being threatened.
Sultana came to Germany a decade ago from Afghanistan when she was just 10 years old. Today, she's about to go to law school, but she's still waiting for her German citizenship. I met her in the eastern state of Thuringia as she was planning a protest against the far-right AfD party, which has just won the most votes in the regional election here.
But you have to understand that this has been the reality for years.
Hi, Damian. We are here in the United Kingdom.
Meanwhile, Parveen, with her new German passport, has been able to visit her sister in London for the first time.
I found London really different than Berlin. I even cried for a couple of times, like, seeing people being so nice to each other.
She's also just qualified as a social worker and is now thinking about moving to the UK because she doesn't feel welcome in Germany anymore. According to one study, a quarter of people with a migrant heritage in Germany are also thinking about leaving, and 10% have concrete plans to emigrate. Sultana, though, is staying, and her anti-racism demo drew huge crowds. Her answer to the far right is not to leave, but to get more politically active.
We have no choice. Many of the migrants have no citizenship and so have no right to vote. But we have voices and we want to take these voices out onto the streets and say, we are here and we are staying here. And we will keep fighting and we will not let our rights be taken away.
Wir lassen uns hier unsere Rechte auch nicht nehmen.
That report was by Damian McGuinness in Germany. Still to come.
The cost has been heavy for both sides in this hell spot in Arnhem. Further south, the Second Army has taken a large haul of enemy prisoners, but in spite of their successes, the British have been unable to force a way through.
80 years on, hundreds of NATO paratroopers have landed near the Dutch city, marking the anniversary of the Second World War Operation Market Garden. Sri Lanka has imposed an overnight curfew across the island, hours after polls closed in the country's presidential election. Voting went peacefully, but the authorities said the additional measure was put in place to ensure public safety. As votes are being counted, security officials have been seen patrolling the streets. The election is widely seen as a referendum on the government's handling of the economy. The full results are not expected until at least Sunday. Our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussein, reports from the capital, Colombo.
2 years ago, skyrocketing inflation and severe shortages of food and petrol sparked mass protests and forced Sri Lanka's deeply unpopular leader, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, from office. The country is still reeling from the effects of the crisis, and the economy remains the most important issue for voters today.
Everything is so expensive at the moment, so we would like a change in that as well. When it comes to daily expenses, when it comes to children's expenses, and everything is expensive. Like mostly the tax is high. Good change in everything, basically.
A lot of things needs to be fixed. The political system, the poverty level. If those things are met, I think that's a comfortable place to stay.
The incumbent, Ranul Wickremesinghe, is running for re-election, but his political future remains uncertain. Tasked with steering Sri Lanka through a period of painful economic reforms, he is largely seen as an ally of the previous government. A Marxist candidate, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, has emerged as an unlikely frontrunner, positioning himself as the voice of Sri Lanka's working class. His nearest rival, Sajith Premadasa, won 42% of the vote in the last election. Now he is relying on his promise to ease the tax burden on Sri Lankans to secure a majority.
Samira Hussein in Sri Lanka. Shells fired into heavily populated areas, dwindling stocks of food and constant power outages. The 500,000 people living in El Fasher, a city in Sudan's Darfur region, have been at the centre of the civil war for months now. There are reports of an upsurge in the fighting at the moment, with the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces pushing forward and the Sudanese Air Force responding with warplanes. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross gave me an update.
It is difficult to get news out because of communications problems, but there have been some videos circulating actually showing some of the fighting. Now, there are militias that are allied to the Sudanese army, and they've been kind of celebrating in recent days as they push back the rapid support forces. But it does seem that the RSF, this paramilitary force, is just so determined to try and capture the city. They've been trying to do that for months, and they're repeatedly shelling areas, and now, according to a UN official, sort of going door-to-door combat as well inside the city. And they're talking about breaching some of the defence positions of the Sudanese army and its allies. So it kind of feels as though the city's under ever-increasing pressure. And, of course, lots of warnings of what may happen if the city were to fall.
I mean, the world is watching. The United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, had said he's gravely alarmed by these reports of a full-scale assault on the city. And yet, what's going to stop the RSF? Pressure on their backers? Is it coming?
It doesn't seem so. I mean, people have kind of talked around the issue. There is lots of evidence that the United Arab Emirates have been backing the rapid support forces, something they deny. But nobody's really spoken out to really call for the backers of the different sides to stop. And any calls for a ceasefire, they've all been ignored. And once again, we're hearing calls from now the UN official in charge of preventing genocide, saying she's worried about what's going to happen if the city falls, and calling on the RSF to stop the assault. The same message from the UN Secretary General, but who knows if anybody's listening.
Will Ross. Saturday was World Alzheimer's Day, the most common cause of dementia, which is a gradual decline in brain functioning. It can affect memory, thinking skills and other mental abilities. Over 55 million people worldwide live with dementia, the majority of them in low and middle-income countries. Krupa Paddy spoke to the journalist and science writer Anthea Rowan, who has written a book, A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. She recalled the moment her mother forgot she was her daughter.
We were on holiday and one evening I asked her if she'd like a drink. Yes, she'd like a drink. I fetched her a cold beer. We sat down and she sort of leant in towards me and she said to me, "Now tell me, when did we first meet?" I really thought that she was joking. I think I laughed. And it was clear that she wasn't joking. And she was a little embarrassed then. And when I said, "I'm your daughter," "Oh, yes, yes, of course you are." But the next morning, she'd obviously been fretting about this all night. And the next morning, she flatly and furiously refused that I was her daughter and said that I must be lying and I looked too old to be her daughter. I collected photographs on my laptop as a sort of PowerPoint who's who, to try to prove I was her daughter, and lending context to that argument that I was her daughter. But she continued to attest that I wasn't her daughter, to the point where I heard her checking with people on the phone. "I hear that Anthea is my daughter. You know, I wish somebody had told me." So it wasn't just the forgetting, but it was this completely skewed logic.
That's a lot to process.
It was, and my eldest daughter said to me, "How does it make you feel?" But I wasn't really able to articulate how it made me feel. I felt very, very shocked. I felt very confused. I really felt at sea. Mm. I didn't know what to feel.
But you knew she had memory loss, so was it that you weren't anticipating this moment?
I didn't know that her memory loss was anything like that. She had had a stroke a few years previously, and the doctors at the time said to us, "There may be some transient memory loss." I have since discovered that a stroke can cause dementia, and quite quickly after it, in somebody who's elderly. So I sort of blamed it on the stroke. I blamed it on the fact that she was elderly. I blamed it on senior moments. I think it was just denial. Denial and a total lack of education about dementia. Mm,
which is so important. And you also write about how you felt alienated, but that was very different to your mother's relationship with your sister.
Yes.
And your granddaughter.
Yes, yes, yeah. She knew all of them. She didn't want me. I had been dispensing all her medications and helping her to bed every evening. She didn't want me to do that anymore. She closed the door and said, no, my sister Carol will help me. Your daughter, Carol, will help me. I didn't feel angry or resentful that at anybody else that she did remember. I just shocked and quite numb. I mean, you never, ever expect that a parent will forget you. And yet I find it is incredibly common in dementia. How that forgetting happens, I think, is different in every case.
And Anthea, you were very honest with your mum about her condition. And I wonder how that played into the dynamic between the two of you.
I was honest to a point. I only ever used the word dementia with her once, and it caused such distress. I never did it again, because later on she came to live with me, and she lived with me for 18 months before she died. And she would often complain, "Oh, my memory is so terrible." And I said to her, "Oh, Mum, you know, you're old, or we all forget for things." I tried to minimise it for her because she knew what that word meant, dementia, and I wasn't going to use it again.
You also write that forgetting is just the beginning.
Yes, forgetting is just the beginning of dementia. And once I had lived with the condition for some months, quite frankly, it's the least of it. It was the least of it in my case. In the end, it didn't matter that she had forgotten who I was. I didn't mind that. Towards the end, I hated that she lost her sense of taste. That was one of the last things she was able to enjoy was food. So it was one of the last things as her carer that I could make a bit of a fuss over her at meals, prepare things for her that I knew she really enjoyed. Her life was so small by then that if she could have one meal that she really enjoyed and really relished, I made it worth it. But when she couldn't taste, I really hated that. And I hated her hallucinations and paranoia. They brought such fear to her.
Anthea Rowan, the journalist and author of the book A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. 700 NATO paratroopers have landed near the Dutch city of Arnhem, part of events to mark the 80th anniversary of the Second World War Operation Market Garden. This was an attempt by Allied troops to capture key bridges in the Netherlands, which they hoped would pave the way for an assault on Nazi Germany. It failed. Our correspondent Anna Holligan watched Saturday's commemoration.
Tens of thousands of people gathered on Ginkel Heath to witness a reenactment of what was one of the bloodiest episodes of the Second World War. 700 paratroopers from several NATO nations, including the UK, Poland and the USA, who were involved in the campaign, parachuted into the fields which saw some of the fiercest fighting.
The cost has been heavy for both sides in this hell spot in Arnhem. Further south, the Second Army has taken a large haul of enemy prisoners, but in spite of their successes, the British have been unable to force a way through.
For Operation Market Garden, 35,000 airborne troops were dropped behind enemy lines in an attempt to carve out a shortcut into Nazi Germany. It was thought that if the bridge at Arnhem could be taken, there was hope of an early invasion of Germany that might have ended the war in December 1944. But after 9 days of relentless fighting, a third of those involved had either been taken prisoner or killed. Jeff Roberts is among the few surviving veterans of Arnhem.
We did our best at the end, so it wasn't quite good enough, but we tried. I'm not a hero, I'm the hero in the cemetery. I'm not a hero.
Operation Market Garden may not have resulted in a military victory, but is remembered for the courage and tenacity demonstrated by the Allied forces. These commemorations aren't just about commemorating the past, but ensuring future generations are conscious of how and by whom freedom was fought.
Anna Holligan in the Netherlands. Now to a decision in France that some are seeing as a victory in the fight against global warming, others as an abuse of power. Officials in Paris have decided to give their 51,000 council workers vegetarian meals twice a week in its canteens in a bid to be more eco-friendly. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
Anyone listing French stereotypes when it comes to food would be quick to get to dishes like steak frites, coq au vin and cordon bleu. And the idea that French cuisine is synonymous with meat or fish dishes is certainly backed by data. The average French person eats 120 kilograms of meat every year, compared to an EU average of 104. And those numbers may be about to go locked down under a new scheme in Paris, which has taken meat and fish off the menu for council workers twice a week.
My colleagues are very unhappy with the decision taken by the city, especially for agents who work physically demanding jobs.
The workers' unions are not happy. Patrick Auffray is the spokesperson for the left-wing Force Ouvrière and says the plan is counterproductive.
I don't have any statistics, but I see many of my colleagues going to the nearby boulangerie instead to get a sandwich with meat, ham or else. In this case, it is neither better for health nor the environment.
It was, of course, in Paris that the International Treaty on Climate Change was signed in 2016, pledging to minimise global warming, with the livestock sector flagged as a problem in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. But food historian Dr. Annie Gray says eating meat is deeply ingrained in French national identity.
From a modern perspective, anyone who's travelled recently in France will know that outside Paris, vegetarian food is very hard to get hold of. And it is regarded, generally speaking, as a kind of lower grade of food. And from a historical point of view, meat has always been very important. You know, you go back to the 16th century and beyond, and you've got kings declaring that their role in life, that their purpose is to put chicken in everybody's pot.
So far, Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, maintains that dishes like broccoli gratin will stay top of menu on Wednesdays and Fridays. And as for the workers the BBC spoke to outside one canteen, while some of them aren't happy,
we need to have the choice to eat what we want. It's a freedom.
Others seem open to meat in the middle.
I still eat meat the rest of the days. It's just 2 days a week, so it's fine.
If you want to make people change, you have to force them in a way. Maybe it can make the mind change. So they won't be happy at first, but I think it's a good thing.
That report was by Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sid Dundon. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.